We're joined in this action by our friends and partners, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Bahrain, and Qatar. America's proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with these nations on behalf of our common security. The strength of this coalition makes it clear to the world that this is not America's fight alone.
President Obama this morning talking about airstrikes carried out in Syria against the militant Islamist group, the Islamic State. Until now, the administration had only bombed the Islamic State in Iraq. While our military campaign expands in the Middle East, there's also concern about extremism here at home. Los Angeles is one of three cities where the administration is starting a program to deter citizens from going to fight with the Islamic State and from launching terror attacks at home. The program is still in the early stages. Full details have not been released, but one LA-based organization is already doing similar work. Salam al-Mariati is president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand you were at a community meeting held by the Department of Homeland Security here in LA this week. What did you learn about the administration's new pilot program?
Well, we actually have our own program called Safe Spaces Initiative, which is based on the PIE model, prevention, intervention, ejection. Prevention in terms of setting the record straight on Islam, that Islam stands for mercy, whereas ISIS stands for cruelty. Islam says respond to the prophet who calls you for life. ISIS calls you to death. Islam says no coercion in religion. ISIS punishes people for not performing their rituals. So that's part of the prevention part. The intervention is if we find troubled people, we intervene. We don't just leave them alone. We don't abandon them.
How do you find troubled people?
I think people find them in our community. It's not looking for them, but they express themselves. And this is exactly part of the training for Safe Spaces, is how can we bring in mental health experts, social service workers, people that can talk about people's perhaps personal identity crisis at the home. That's important. Then if we find out that a person is going down that path of violent extremism, we bring in the experts on that issue, which is law enforcement. And that's exactly what the federal government now is pursuing. It's called what they call it is prevention, intervention, interdiction. So it's very similar, and we're actually very happy that the federal government is adopting our policies. The federal government is also saying that they would like to see countering violent extremism more community-driven as opposed to law enforcement-driven.
So what do you see? What are some of the signs that someone might be considering going abroad, going to Syria and joining the Islamic State, for example?
Well, there are no obvious signs. It's like a person joining a gang. A person joins a gang because they feel there's no belongingness in their community or in their home or in their house of worship, so they join a gang. And basically, ISIS is that gang. They may go join ISIS because they think that this is part of a glorious past that they can relive. There is no glorious past. So there's a distortion of the world and a distortion of religion there. So there really is no public way of identifying people like that, but it does come across when you have conversations. The problem is, of course, we're trying to reach the unreachables. These individuals who have decided to join ISIS do it on their own in the privacy of their homes, on the internet, and then they go and join ISIS. And what we're saying is we need to empower communities to have conversations so that if they hear about somebody who's doing that, we can try to rehabilitate that person before they make that decision.
So are you doing similar things online? Are you trying to counter their online message? Because we've heard a lot about ISIS's sophisticated use of the internet and recruitment videos. You know, some are imitating violent video games and things like that to make it look like it's a big adventure and a lot of fun to go to Syria and wage jihad. So is there anything that you can do along those lines to counter that?
There's a lot. And, of course, there's so much more to do than we're able to do. And this is why we're saying that these programs need more resources and an infusion of resources into these communities. But yes, technology, YouTube, videos, social messaging, I think all these are important avenues to communicate with people. We do it. We don't do it in the best way we think we can do. We can do a lot better job. And we've met with people within Hollywood and technology to see how we can get that message out better. We had a YouTube video that got almost 1 million hits, I think. It's called Injustice Cannot Defeat Injustice. So, yes, we see all the harm that Muslims are inflicted with, and we see oppression and tyranny and occupation against Muslims. But the way we respond to it is the Islamic call, you repel evil with that which is good, so that the one with whom there is enmity becomes as if he is your closest friend. That's the Islamic message we want to get out, but it has to go out through effective means of social media.
Well, how do you counter someone who believes that the United States is the enemy, that the United States is the one that is inflicting harm on Muslims?
Well, I mean, again, can we rehabilitate that person? I think that's the first thing that has to be considered. If you can't rehabilitate the person, and that person is going to be involved in some criminal activity, then we have to leave it to those experts. But the point is, ISIS is an ideology. You cannot bomb ideas out of people. You can only replace bad ideas with good ideas. You can counter the cult of death with the theology of life. You can extinguish that darkness only with light, and that's our approach.
Now, Los Angeles was one of three cities chosen for this federal pilot program. Why Los Angeles? It doesn't seem like it would be a hotbed for potential
radicals. It's not. And actually, this is what was interesting about the way the federal government announced the program. They look at Los Angeles as a model for a partnership between law enforcement and our community. And so we were invited to go to a federal law enforcement training conference to explain what's working in Los Angeles in terms of the partnership. And I think that's why they chose Los Angeles. So the way it came out was different, as if there's a threat here. There's no threat. And it's mainly an issue of being proactive and applying this violence prevention program that we're talking about.
What about an overall threat? Is there one, or is it being overstated in terms of, you know, people getting trained to come back here to wage terrorism?
It's more of a threat in Europe than in the United States. There are more foreign fighters from Europe, and I think there are social reasons. There are obviously geographic reasons why that's the case. Muslims in Europe are more alienated. There's much more overt discrimination against Muslim communities in Europe. They're actually living in ethnic ghettos. So when we talk about Muslims in France, it's actually Algerian communities. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about Muslims in Germany, we're talking about Turkic communities, and so on and so forth. In America, we're much more dispersed. There's a higher level of socioeconomic integration and success in America, so I think there's less of a propensity for somebody feeling alienated. And obviously, the geography is different, that it would take more to go from here. It's the bottom line is we're trying to reach that unreachable person who may decide to go. And finding that needle in the haystack. But at the same time, I think we should do everything we can to prevent any kind of violence from happening.
Salam al-Mariati is president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The U.S. launched an airstrike campaign against the Islamic State in Syria, but the Islamic State wasn't the only group who was bombed last night.
Last night, we also took strikes to disrupt plotting against the United States and our allies by seasoned al-Qaeda operatives in Syria who are known as the Khorasan Group. And once again, it must be clear to anyone who would plot against America and try to do Americans harm that we will not tolerate safe havens for terrorists who threaten our people.
The Khorasan Group, al-Qaeda affiliated, based around the city of Aleppo. Who? To get a sense of who they are and why we've decided to bomb them, we're joined by Aki Peretz. He is a former counterterrorism expert for the CIA and the author of the book Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated al-Qaeda. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Well, we haven't heard much about this group until, really, late last week when National Intelligence Director James Clapper pointed out on Thursday that this group may be more of a threat to the United States than ISIS. So, and now this bombing campaign against them, why the sudden escalation?
Well, you know, it's actually quite interesting. For those of us who follow the Syria jihad and the Iraq jihad very closely, we actually haven't even heard of this group either. It's run by a 33-year-old senior al-Qaeda operative who's been in the jihadi business for better, you know, over a decade now. But the fact is that he has a willing and capable organization ready to go in Syria came as not as news, but it's interesting that they sort of now have a nickname of the Khorasan group when they're really sort of really part of an established organization called Jabhat al-Nusra, or the al-Nusra group, that's been around for a number of years.
Yeah, so al-Nusra is pretty well known. It's been fighting in Syria, and it's an offshoot of al-Qaeda. And Khorasan then is an offshoot of al-Nusra, or just a renaming?
No, it's probably for Western audiences, it's basically just a number of fellows who came from the Afghanistan-Pakistan region who went to Syria through a variety of means, and are using that as a place to either recruit individuals, to plan attacks, to develop all kinds of things in that area, which will be used to attack the homeland. So, for example, the airstrikes that we carried out last night hit command and control areas. It hit communications. It hit training camps and so forth, and it shows that they had a level of sophistication that we didn't quite really know beforehand.
Right, and we're hearing just today or recently that they had plans to hit either Europe or the United States. So why is it that we haven't heard more about them from the White House?
It's difficult to have multiple enemies at the same time. And so, as we all know, ISIS has been the boogeyman that's been scaring the West. And at the end of the day, ISIS is an enormously powerful organization with hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of thousands of men under arms, and controlling a large swath of territory. But that doesn't mean that the United States government has taken its eye off the ball of standard sort of traditional al-Qaeda groups like Jabhat al-Nusra. In January, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said that Jabhat al-Nusra had aspirationally was interested in hitting the homeland. And this may be sort of the follow-on of this.
All right. And these groups, are they being coordinated by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now the leader of al-Qaeda?
Chances are they have some sort of relationship with core al-Qaeda back in Pakistan. But remember that ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra have had a huge falling out over the last year. So, for example, there's something called fitna, which is basically discord among these organizations. Ayman al-Zawahiri sent one of his top lieutenants, a fellow named Abu Khalid al-Suri, to Syria to sort everything out, to make sure that everybody was happy. And what did ISIS do? It blew him up with a suicide attack. That didn't really help things back in Pakistan. And so ISIS was disavowed, and now Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS have been each other's throats the last year.
So there's an internal war within al-Qaeda or within these jihadi groups.
Within the jihadi groups, yes.
Yeah.
And ISIS has been very good about taking out people, especially top leadership in other Islamic jihadi groups within Syria. They've been extremely effective.
So in this tangled web that is Syria and who's aligned with whom, in a strange way, by attacking Khorasan and al-Nusra, aren't we helping out ISIS?
We are, and, you know, that's that shop-worn phrase that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But in this case, all these guys are enemies. And so if we have to take anything from this, is that we should be able to take out the individuals who pose the greatest threat to the United States, which is ISIS, but also these individual fighters within Jabhat al-Nusra who are actively participating in external attacks or planning for external attacks. And that's, I think, what happened late last night.
Well, I guess there is a question then as to who does pose the bigger threat to the United States. Is it ISIS or is it al-Nusra or is it someone else?
Well, I wouldn't really say it's an either-or kind of situation. ISIS has thousands of foreign fighters with American and European passports. Your guest prior to me talked about this. And these individuals understand the West because they grew up in the West, and they understand how to subvert traditional Western security practices, let's say airport security, because all they have to show is their, let's say, their British passport or their German passport or their American passport. Jabhat al-Nusra has fewer foreign fighters, but these are people who are probably more committed. So it's not really an either-or kind of situation. They're both truly awful organizations that have to be really stopped.
Okay, so the United States is bombing both of them, and meanwhile, what happens with the Syrian forces and Bashar al-Assad?
Well, they're probably sitting very pretty because they've been waging a campaign, not so much against ISIS, but against the moderate rebel groups that that we in the United States really like. Because ISIS has been a great sort of battering ram against these moderate forces. They sometimes are called Free Syrian Army, sometimes they're called other things. And so they're basically staying out of this, and they're waiting for the dust to settle because the United States and the other allies are actually attacking all their enemies at the same time. And so they just have to sort of wait back and see how it all shakes out.
Okay, and meanwhile, where is Saudi Arabia in this? Are they at all funding these groups, Khorasan, al-Nusra, or ISIS?
That's one of the $64 million questions, or probably more like a $500 million question. Officially, Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, does not support these organizations, and they've been dedicated against al-Qaeda really for the last 10, 15 years. However, that doesn't mean that individual philanthropists, I guess if you want to call it that, have not been providing funds to organizations like ISIS, al-Nusra, et cetera. The United States really has to help Saudi Arabia crack down on these people because eventually these hardcore jihadis have their eye overthrowing the Kingdom of Saud. They just haven't gotten to there yet. Because the Saudis are keeping a lid on their problems, but the Saudis themselves, the Saudi government, is not actually funding these organizations.
All right. Well, thank you for shedding some light on this.
Clear as mud.
Exactly. Aki Peretz, counterterrorism expert, formerly with the CIA and author of the book Find, Fix, Finish: Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al Qaeda. All right, coming up, we are going to shift gears quite a bit. My conversation with a man who helped popularize surfing in the United States, in fact, worldwide, John Severson, 80 years old. He founded Surfer Magazine, influenced the Beach Boys with his homegrown surfing movies. My conversation with him next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hurricanes in Baja caused some pretty gnarly epic waves recently here in Southern California. The largest waves reached up to 20 feet. That's something that John Severson knows something about. He's lived much of his life riding waves, some of them that big. In fact, he helped popularize and shape American surf culture basically since the 1950s. Now he has a big new coffee table book out featuring his photographs and paintings. It's called From Decades of a Life Spent at the Center of Surfing Culture. The book is called John Severson Surf, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
How old were you when you first surfed? When was your first surfing trip?
I was 12 years old. Summer came, and a friend said, well, you better come down to the pier tomorrow. Why? He said, you'll see. So we got to the pier, and there was a little club of kids there. We learned to body surf and belly board, ride mats, and then eventually ride surfboards. And it was my introduction to surfing.
And this is in Laguna, in San Clemente?
This was San Clemente.
Uh-huh.
My dad had moved us down there. He had a midlife crisis, and off we went. We moved to this beach town, which we thought was way off the grid. Nothing was happening down there, and it turned out everything was happening. And it was, well, at that time, there were only three surfers, high school surfers in the whole town, my brother and I and a friend. So things have changed a bit.
Yeah, I bet. So you first started surfing when you were 12, and you were just bitten by the bug then and didn't look back?
I was gone. I was gone, and my brother was gone. And we went to the beach every day. And the second summer, my dad called us in and said, "You boys are spending too much time at that beach." And he said, "If you're not careful, you'll end up like Woody, living in the shack and surfing and fishing." I thought, wow, I didn't know there was a career opportunity like that. My dad got us jobs washing dishes. That slowed us down a bit, but not much.
So you actually did make your career doing that?
Actually, yes, with a few twists. I realized in a hurry that if you wanted to surf, you'd better have something to back it up. So I worked hard, worked my way through college, so I'd be able to support this surfing habit. And so that was always my goal, was to support the easy life with the hard life.
Right. But you made money painting. You did your own paintings and illustrations, took photographs.
A little bit painting. I painted in Long Beach State in a workshop. And my instructor said, "Well, paint what you love." And I thought, well, okay, surfing. And then everything got perfect in my life. I was teaching at Laguna Beach High School, and surfing and painting, and the Army drafted me. And within 2 weeks, I was done, gone. I thought it was a huge train wreck, wrecking my life. And off I went to basic training. And after training in communications, Morse code, I got sent to Hawaii, and everything changed. I was able to finally surf those beautiful waves of the islands.
Wait,
and the big, big waves.
You were sent to Hawaii as part of being drafted?
Yeah. This is 1956. We're basically at peace with everyone.
Peacetime draft.
So they drafted me, and I was about to go to Germany when the guy in front of me flunked Morse code. So I got moved up one slot to Hawaii, which was just a huge, colossal break in my life.
Wow, lucky you.
Because in Hawaii, I was able to surf the big waves and continue this photography hobby I had, now shooting great surf.
And you were also on an Army surf team?
They assigned me to the Army surf team with orders that read, "You will practice every afternoon at noon at Makaha or Sunset Beach." Well, that fit perfectly with my the rest of my job, which was illustrator and artist for the general staff. And on the side, I painted watercolors of surfing and island life and sold those on the hedge and made a film called Surf. And a friend of mine took it back to California, and I started getting checks in the mail. And my whole life changed from teacher to filmmaker. And then from filmmaker, I started Surfer Magazine.
Wow. Let's go back to those movies. You started making these surf movies, and these were basically footage that you shot, and then you would just edit it together and then play music live to the audience in the theater and then do live narration?
Exactly. Yes, that's just it.
And they ended up being really popular. Did that surprise you?
Yeah. Well, at first it was all we had for surf imagery. So I just made the most beautiful films I could. I put a lot of art into them, a lot of lettering, and picked my music carefully. I was the first one to put real coordinated music scores together behind the surf and sound effects. And so I had a good time with it. You weren't making dramatic films, no film noirs or anything like that. It was just surf films interrupted or say mellowed out with art and and comedy routines. I owe a lot to the Keystone Cops and the silent films.
And one of your movies was called Surf Safari, and I guess the Beach Boys saw it.
Oh, the Beach Boys saw it, and they loved it, and so they wrote a piece somewhat similar called Surf and Safari.
Yeah,
but that didn't bother me. Everybody seemed to be borrowing from everybody else, and that was fine, Surf and Safari. I thought, publicity.
Yeah. If you're just joining me, I'm talking with John Severson. He has a new book out called John Severson Surf. You did a lot of movies, which were popular, and then you started Surfer Magazine, and that really took off. Tell me about
how
you started it and what the philosophy was behind the magazine.
Well, I started as an annual to go along with my films, and I thought, what would I like to see? And I thought, the best pictures and a few stories about it and some art and cartoons. And so I designed the first booklet as more of a celebration of where we are and what was happening. And my brother took 50 magazines down to Hap Jacobs' shop, and he couldn't get in the shop. So he called me. He said, I couldn't get in. There was a riot. And I thought, oh, wow, what else is going to happen? And he said, yeah, they were rioting to get the Surfer magazine. So that happened all up and down the coast, and off we went.
What do you think it was about it that provoked rioting, that people liked it so much?
I think I wasn't afraid to deviate from reality to play up the fantasies and use the hard black and big black and white things. I did my own lettering and the first big wave, really good big wave still pictures. And I just let it rip. What was happening? I didn't create a surf culture. I reflected it.
So this was in the 1960s. And by then, surfing was pretty big, right? It was pretty popular. You had the Gidget movies, for instance, and the Beach Boys we talked about. When did surfing become big time? You were there at the beginning of this, when it was just, as you say, you and a couple guys out in San Clemente, and now it's, you know, a multi-million dollar sport, and the waves are crowded with surfers. When did it turn?
Oh, well, when did it become big time?
When did you notice it turning from this small kind of sport?
What's your definition of big time?
Well, that it became mainstream, I guess, and that lots of people did it.
Yeah. Well, we always thought it was just a step beyond where it should be. And, it made a big jump when we went from redwood balsa to pure balsa boards, and that lightened up the board by half. You were down to 35, 40 pounds. You could flip them around, and they were wonderful. We thought that's as far as we could go. But we were sawing down all the balsa forests, so we were about to run out of our supply. I would have to say surfing was becoming big time then, because what we needed to do was build a financial base so that someone paid attention to us and didn't try to outlaw surfing, as a lot of cities were doing. And so we'd reached that point, and that supported all the technology into foam boards, plastic boards.
And fiberglass.
And once the foam and plastic, that really sent us off, even though we've had things happen since that are much more commercial, which I'm not a big fan of, and a lot of people aren't big fans of, but it comes with it. You can't stop it. We never could have stopped it.
You said cities were outlawing surfing. I think you write in the book about when Richard Nixon moved back to San Clemente, he moved into a house next door to yours.
That was the Western White House out there, and he lived in the house right next door to me. And his Secret Service was very busy trying to keep surfing out of in front of his estate.
And you had to actually negotiate with his advisors?
I negotiated with Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman. He was tough. But what would you expect? Of course.
So in your book, you wrote about postponing your wedding because there was a good surf up.
Well, absolutely.
What did your wife think of that?
Well, first of all, we had 2 cents in the bank and a credit card. We were living off the credit card. And here was this day. I hadn't seen anything like it. And I thought, I'm here. I can get this. I might have been the only surf photographer there at the time. I can get this wonderful footage, and it'll make the film. And I explained it to her that way. And, of course, it's really hard to tell you, but honey, we can always get married tomorrow. Well, she understood perfectly. She said, yes, we'll shoot the footage today and get married tomorrow. And we did, and it's 55 years. Yay.
That's so great.
Louise.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're 81 years old now, right?
Not quite. You could say 80 and a half, you know, okay. Like the little kids, the four and a half, five and a half. Yeah, I'm 80.
You're 80 and a half.
80 and a half.
Do you still surf?
I surf a little bit. My legs don't have the punch they used to have, so on big waves, I can't afford to be late. So I surf smaller waves, and I'm boogie board occasionally and try to get wet. get wet, feel better.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Is it over so soon? Oh, it's been great. Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking with John Severson. He has a new book out. It's a gorgeous coffee table book called John Severson Surf. And if you want to meet John, he'll be at Arcana Books in Culver City tomorrow night. He'll be there from 6 till 8 p.m. Coming up on the program, we're going to talk about the cozy relationship between Google and Stanford. It's tested over privacy research. We're going to have that story after a news update with KCRW's Cherry Glazer.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play from KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Stanford University has a close relationship with nearby Google. In fact, Google's founders went to Stanford, where they first came up with their billion-dollar idea. Google has long donated to Stanford, and the university has used the money to pay for lots of research, including research on internet privacy. And that has proven to be a little, shall we say, awkward, given the fact that research conducted by Stanford led to a privacy-related fine against Google for around $22 million. Now the Stanford Center that conducted that research is no longer getting money from Google to study privacy. But both Stanford and Google say there's no link. We're joined now by Robert Federici, who wrote about this for ProPublica. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's my pleasure. Well, first, tell us about that research that led to the fine against Google.
Yeah, so basically that research was conducted by one of the researchers at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. And, you know, it was done by a researcher named Jonathan Mayer. And basically what it found is that, that Google was circumventing users' privacy choices in Apple's Safari web browser.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had not been very public about that fact. And so Mayer's research helped lead to government regulators fining Google, millions of dollars.
So this was when Google had actually funded this kind of research at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford?
Yeah, so this center has been around for years, and from its inception, it's been generously funded by Google.
All right, so now it's not getting the money from Google to study privacy. And is there a link between that fine and the decision not to have Google fund the privacy research?
So both Stanford and Google say there's no link. Basically, Stanford, you know, This admission came in a sort of an obscure court filing. It was one line in like a 33-page document, and basically what it said was, you know, Stanford saying that since last year, Google funding is specifically designated not to be used for privacy work. So we went to Stanford with this, and what they've been saying is that, you know, this specific designation not to use the money for privacy work does not amount to a prohibition, that this is simply, you know, they simply had other money for privacy research, and, you know, they often will tell funders that they're going to use money for one thing and then use it for another.
We actually have a clip of tape from Jennifer Granick, the director of the center, so let's play it and let's hear it from her.
Great.
Stanford never promised not to use Google money for privacy research. We have policies which say that all donors to our program and to Stanford more generally give their funds as unrestricted gifts, and there's no promises or representations about what will be done with that money. Our policy in 2013 was that we had other funding sources for our consumer privacy work, and so we asked for, got, and designated Google money to be used for different projects. We may very well ask Google for money for our privacy research in the future.
Okay, so what do you make of that, Robert Federici?
So, you know, I am not, you know, before this article, I was no expert in, you know, sort of academic ethics. So, you know, obviously we took the court filing to folks who are experts, and we told them that Stanford is acknowledging that the money they're taking from Google is specifically designated not to be used for privacy work. And, you know, pretty much everyone we talked to universally said that this was, you know, a huge etiquette breach, that it's very unusual, that it's, you know, it really threatens academic freedom to restrict the use of money for one topic. So, the way it works is funders often will fund research into a specific topic. That's not controversial because it sort of allows the research to sort of go where the data leads. But it's really unusual for one area to be, you know, specifically designated against, because you could be researching, say, copyright, and that could lead to, you know, research about ebooks, which could lead to research about user logins, which, boom, is a privacy issue, because it helps companies track what users are reading. And so if you restrict one area, you basically create a situation where a researcher might have to sort of shy away from where the evidence leads or not publish on that topic, and it creates academic freedom concerns. So that's basically been the response of, you know, experts in this field. They say that this is problematic.
But you found this line actually in a document that says Google funding is specifically designated not to be used for the privacy work at the center. So
yeah, and that was a filing from Stanford itself.
Right.
This wasn't someone describing Stanford on behalf of Stanford. This was Stanford's filing.
That seems to be at odds with what we just heard from Jennifer Granick.
You know, I tend to agree. I mean, I can't say that we still fully understand Stanford's response, and it's really not for a lack of trying. It seems as though their response contradicts this filing, so it's hard to understand where they're coming from.
And then it's unclear whether or not, if indeed this is the case, this is their policy, whether they initiated it on their own behalf or whether they initiated it at the behest of Google.
So they're saying they initiated it, and Google is saying that as well. And, you know, I took that to an expert in academic ethics, and what he said is that it's actually more troubling if it's Stanford who initiated this. I mean, what he said is that universities are supposed to kind of watch out for these kinds of infringements and not let them happen, and they're definitely not supposed to initiate it. You know, they're supposed to safeguard against it, and Stanford is basically saying, you know, not only did we not safeguard against it, but we're the ones who initiated it.
Does Google fund any kind of research along privacy lines at any other university?
They do. And they, you know, in the past helped fund privacy research at Stanford.
All right. Well, Robert Federici, a reporter at ProPublica, formerly of the LA Times. I was going to give you the LA Times ID, but that's no longer ProPublica. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Madeline.
My pleasure. Julie Myers is here with some feedback. Hello.
I've got the feedback on a Tuesday that has felt like a Wednesday all day today. I almost called it the wrong day while we're mislabeling things. So we talked to a surf god on the show today, Severson. Great interview. And we wanted to hear from you guys, future surf gods of America. We wanted to know what your favorite local surf break was. The first thing I needed to learn was what a surf break was. I figured that out. Apparently, it is a surf spot. Then I learned that surfers apparently favor Twitter over Facebook. That's where the conversation is happening today. And finally, I learned about where you all like to surf, the whole point of this thing. Aaron Kubasek tweeted us that nothing beats old mans in San O. That's San Onofre State Beach for the uninitiated, like me. Another thing I learned. KCRW's very own Tyler Hale weighed in as well. He tweeted that he's a county line guy, but he's a big fan of loading up the car and heading down to San O for the day as well. And yet another KCRW producer tweeted us. Colin Walzak says, surfing's hard. Don't try it. Well, if you disagree with Colin, which I'm sure many of you do, we want to hear from you. So jump in on Twitter, which is where the conversation is happening in earnest, or you can start up the conversation on Facebook as well. Lots of places to weigh in on your favorite surf spot or why we need to be quiet about not wanting to surf. And perhaps somebody will convince me
to
get on a board.
Are you convinced at all? Are you tempted?
I plug my nose when I go underwater, so I don't know if I'm the right market for it.
I tried it once. It is really, really hard.
I believe that.
Hard. Of course, my kid got right up there and did a headstand on the board. I know, kids.
Yeah, kids
we
and
didn't
dogs.
Have far to fall.
I've watched a lot of videos of surfing dogs. Does that make me a surfer? No?
Maybe. Internet surfer.
Good.
All right. Yeah. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
Warren Olney and To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.